Hey everyone, Chase here. Just have a few announcements before we get started today. First of all, if you're not already listening to the Everything 90s podcast, you really should. Shalina, the host of Everything 90s, is in the middle of her third annual 90s versus 2000 series where guest podcasters debate which decade had better stuff. I was just on that show representing the 90s, talking about Nickelodeon shows. My opponent is Brandon from Namely 90s, who was kind enough to step in and represent the aughts. So if you're listening to this show really soon after it went up, you might still have time to go over to Everything 90s, listen to that latest episode, and vote on who you think had the better lineup. And hey, you know, listen to Everything 90s and Namely 90s. Those are great shows. And also, please vote for me. I really need a win here, you guys. Second, our website is back, baby! It's at a different URL now. You can go to snescapades.show, and you'll see info about our most recent episodes. So, just everything from season 2 onward. It's got our current game rankings on there. It's got show notes, which is going to have links to, like, Works Cited and things like that. And, you know, some other fun things in there, too. So, hope you like it. I worked really hard on it. Built it in React all by myself. It is hosted on a free service, so it might be slow to load sometimes. Sorry about that, but, you know, it's not like I'm making any money off of this thing. On that note, though, if you do know anyone who is hiring React developers or web developers in general, please let me know. I'd really like to end 2024 with a better job. Anyway, that's all for now. On with the show. Let's go! It's Snescapades, a chronological journey through the North American Super Nintendo library with a few pit stops along the way. We play them briefly, we judge them harshly, we rank them. That is pretty much all you need to know. I am Chase Keys.
And I'm Amy Zero.
And folks, we are back at the start, back at the beginning. We talked about the August 1991 issue of Nintendo Power last time, which means now we are getting back into the games of August 1991. Pretty short number of games, you know, pretty short list for this first month.
So short. There's only five games that came out in August 1991, folks, and they are all consequential enough that we decided not to do any kind of a selection process for these. We're just going to talk about all of them because they're all worth it.
For this first one, we're going to talk about Super Mario World and F-Zero. Two of the big launch titles, I think probably the two biggest launch titles for the system. I mean, Super Mario World was a pack-in.
A huge launch title for the system. And I think F-Zero, one of the primary tech showcases for the system, a really kind of just like new thing, like a kind of, hey, look at what this baby can do sort of deal. So, and of course, both of them first party Nintendo games. And, you know, I got to say, really, after having gone through several years of the Super Nintendo's library, really eye-opening to go back to these very first games.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't know if my opinions on them have changed too much. Although, I don't know, we might see some shifting around of things on the list today. I don't know. We will see.
Well, what do you say we get into it?
Yeah, so what if we start with F-Zero? Because that'll probably be the shorter one of the two, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think so. I think we should start with F-Zero. This is a game that I was really pleased to be playing again. You know, it was just like slipping on a comfortable pair of shoes. You know, we are going to try to talk about these games in, you know, a way that sort of comports with our kind of current process for how we do the show. And I think that means, you know, I would like to talk at least a little bit about the manuals for these games, because I read all the manuals for these and we didn't quite really have access to them, to those back when we started, or at least we didn't think to have this as part of the thing. F-Zero has a good manual. It's got a really fun bit of lore and world building that talks about all of the planets and the characters who are driving the F-Zero cars. So yeah,
which is good, because I don't think any of that stuff is anywhere in the game.
None of it's in the game. Absolutely none. They have cool character designs, and none of them are in the game. It's honestly kind of funny.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
This is like one of the most famous Nintendo series, but that hasn't really had an active presence in a long time, I guess I should say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's a thing that people do badly want Nintendo to bring back in some way, and we kind of got a little bit of that this year, but not really what anybody sort of hoped for, I think.
Yeah, although I will say, like, I think that F-Zero 99, the online multiplayer version of this F-Zero game, is maybe, like, a very smart way of bringing this game back. I think smarter than just, you know, putting the game back out on Virtual Console, which I'm pretty sure it is part of, or not Virtual Console.
It is. Yeah, you can play it on the Nintendo Switch Online thing, for sure. Yeah, I mean, they haven't made a new F-Zero game in about 20 years at this point. So, you know, F-Zero 99, I think, is a really neat thing. But I also think people are really hoping that at some point Nintendo will just be like, you know what, let's do another one of these, like, for real, like, big budget. Let's really kind of, you know, blow the doors off this thing. And yeah, it is Nintendo's other racing game series, right? Apart from Mario Kart, futuristic hover cars. It's very fast. It is a technical showcase on the Super Nintendo. It is a technical showcase for the Mode 7 graphics mode, so that you have these really fast, really kind of elaborate, but flat courses. And yeah, I just, you know, it's a simple game, maybe too simple, you could argue, given that it is only a one-player game. But man, the vibes are impeccable in F-Zero. Like, just some of the best music, great visual design, and I think it controls exceptionally well.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest racing fan, but I will definitely say, like, yeah, there are some pretty good vibes. This is almost kind of like, you know, is somebody who likes this sort of stuff, it's almost a vapor wavy kind of game.
It is almost. Yeah, it's true. Going back to the manual, we do have a little bit of, like, background on the world of F-Zero. And it turns out F-Zero, the F-Zero Grand Prix, it exists because of rich people. It's basically in the distant future. You know, there's a big intergalactic, you know, world of different planets and aliens and all of this stuff. And they're just rich people that are too freaking rich. And they've decided to spend some of their money making an elaborate racing league that is described as being sort of a callback to the Formula One races of the 20th century. Yeah, you got four different hover ships, F-Zero racing vehicles. Each of them has a pilot. The pilots are not mentioned in the game at all, but there's a lot of info about them in the manuals. In the manual, Captain Falcon is there, probably the most famous, the only famous F-Zero character.
Yeah, thanks to his presence in Smash Brothers.
Yep. There's an alien guy who kind of looks like Piccolo from Dragon Ball. There's a kind of, you know, fancy ladies' man character named Dr. Stewart. And there's this big sort of bruiser guy named Samurai Goro. And Samurai Goro is the driver of the pink ship, which is the only ship I ever use when I'm playing this game. So, you know, it's fun. It's a fun, like, you know, world setting. And the last, like, 10 pages of the 25-page manual are a little comic book about these characters. And it's just cool. It's, like, exactly the style of, like, a Nintendo Power comic. And I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Good stuff there. We're going to be talking about a lot of interesting manuals for August 91. But
absolutely. They really put they put a lot of effort into the manuals for these early games. Definitely.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I need to start, you know, bringing the mood down a little bit and criticizing this game in a few ways. Like I said, I think that the F-Zero 99 was maybe the best way to bring this game back. I think that was a really clever choice because I think this game on its own is it just feels very feature poor. It feels like it was a tech demo that kind of got put onto its own cartridge. Like I think back to like when the NES was packaged with the cartridge that had Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt on it. It was like, hey, here's the main event. It's Super Mario Brothers, but also like, hey, check out this cool thing that you can do with this as well. This is Duck Hunt. I almost feel like F-Zero in Mario World could have been the same kind of thing. Like you could have put F-Zero as like, hey, this is a fun little bonus thing here on the Super Mario World cartridge. And I don't know. Like it feels a bit limited to me, despite the very good music, cool vibes and, you know, solid mechanics. There's just not a whole lot there, especially given like the kinds of racing games that would come out on this system later on.
I mean, you're not wrong about that. I do think, though, that for me personally, I think you're underselling how good the controls are, because I think something I discovered when I was playing the game this time is that the skill ceiling on this game is a lot higher than I thought it was. Like, I figured out how to do some cool stuff on the tracks in this that felt incredible to play. And, you know, that were just a lot more nuance. I feel like there's more nuance to the controls in this game than I expected there to be. And yeah, you know, I just think that, so, okay, I'm an odd person when it comes to racing games. I do like racing games, mostly more on like the arcadey side of things. But generally speaking, I mostly play racing games single player anyway. So I don't so much mind the simplicity of the modes here. I do wish there were more cars. I think it's really true that the limited number of cars and the fact that, frankly, I think that I wish I could remember its name, but I the pink car is so much more like comfortable feeling to drive than any of the other ones that it feels like that's almost like the only viable car for some of these tracks, to me at least. You know, I think that you can kind of see Nintendo maybe struggling against some of their own impulses for how you build a game in this, because this does feel oddly closer to their non-racing games than you might expect. You have lives, for one thing. Like, there's actually, like, you know, that's kind of strange. The fact that, you know, it's broken down into three different sort of cups, basically, kind of the same way that Mario Kart would be. And, you know, they all take place on variations of the same seven levels. And yeah, there's a real emphasis on different sort of little gimmicks on the stages. You know, sometimes they'll have magnets that'll pull you and push you around. Some of them will have essentially ice that will make it very, very slip slidey. There's one kind of infamous stage with a giant ramp jump in it that you have to know how to do a specific control maneuver that even the manual doesn't tell you about in order to get over it. And yeah, you know, it all feels like it's almost of a piece with like a platform game or something. But it is pretty simple. I think they hit on something really good and really specific with this. That the thing with for me is that I don't know that any of the other F-Zero games necessarily got this feel back. You know, I think that I kind of wish that the later F-Zero games that they did make had stuck with the particular sort of look and feel of this and just sort of enhanced it, but they didn't really do that. You know, F-Zero X for the Nintendo 64 has like kind of like butt rocky metal versions of all of the background, all of the track music from this game. It's fine. It's pretty good. it's not really what I want, but, you know, it's all right. And then F-Zero GX, which a lot of people would argue is kind of the pinnacle of this series, is a really brutally hard, really fast game that feels just GameCube as hell. And, you know, those are good. But the fact that I can really only get, like, this sort of ideal F-Zero experience from this one game, and I guess now also F-Zero 99 for however long that lasts, does kind of give this one some extra points for me, maybe. But, yeah, I really like this game. It's, you know, a childhood favorite of mine that I think is still really fun to play. But I don't think you're wrong. I think that there is... This does feel... kind of tech demo-y, proof of concept-y, but I think it's really good at, like, the little slice of something that it does.
Okay. So, you know, I was kind of ready to come in here and say, like, does this really deserve to be in the A tier just due to the kind of limited feature set that we see in this game? But I think you've made a pretty good case that this one absolutely sticks around in the A tier.
I mean, for me at least, I think this is an A tier game.
You know what? I'm sold. You've sold me on it. I say it stays in the A tier then. Anything else for this one before we move on to our other game for today?
No. I don't think so. All
right. Well, folks, we're going to talk about it again. It is one of my favorite games ever. And it was, you know, at the top of our list when we were ranking it from day one and then never dethroned. You know, someday maybe we'll go back to the whole, you know, individually ranked thing to discuss our top 100 games on the system, maybe after this whole project is over. But hey, for right now, let's talk about Super Mario World. Yes, this is this was the pack-in title of the system, originally anyway. This was basically Super Mario Brothers 4.
That was its original name.
Yep, and I think this is maybe one of the best games ever made. But before we go too far into it, I decided that since we're doing deep dives now, it might be fun to go back. And I actually started, this was going to be like a very shallow deep dive, you might say, into the overall history of Nintendo. But
yeah,
this ended up kind of turning into more of a conversation about the Yamauchi lineage. So let's talk about that.
Oh, okay, sure.
For today's deep dive. The story of Nintendo starts in, you guessed it, the 80s! The 1880s. Woo! 1889, to be exact. It was founded by Fusajiro Yamauchi as Nintendo Koppai in Kyoto as a playing card company. Now, it's kind of important to note that playing cards have had a somewhat tumultuous history in Japan for a couple of reasons, not the least of which was that in 1648, a popular type of playing card called Kensho Karuta were banned in Japan as a result of Sokoku, which was the isolationist foreign policy instituted by the Tokugawa shogunate. This was due to the fact that these playing cards were based on a playing card deck brought over by the Portuguese. Or, well, a Portuguese get deck. I don't actually know if it was the Portuguese who brought it over, but it was based on a Portuguese deck. And the Tokugawa shogunate apparently decided, hey, that's too much like a foreign influence, and we're isolationists now, so none of this. But just like life and genetically manufactured dinosaurs, fun finds a way, and other card games were invented in the country. But even this was a little bit rocky because of the illegal status of gambling in the country. This is how Hanafuda cards became to be, literally flower cards. The fact that these just featured pictures of flowers and things like that, and not numbers, kind of helped them to skirt the gambling laws that were around in Japan. And it made these decks a little bit more popular. They started gaining a little bit of notoriety. And by the time that Yamauchi formed Nintendo in 1889, the cards weren't quite as taboo, but he sought to make these things really popular. So he started by making these really gorgeous hand-painted Hanafuda cards. They became popular, so they began mass producing them in the early 1900s. Western-style playing cards followed suit. See what I did there? Helping Nintendo Kōpai become the biggest playing card company in Japan. Fusajiro never had a son, and he couldn't leave the company to his daughters. Yay, Japanese institutionalized misogyny. But he was impressed with a young man named Sekiryo Kaneda. Now, an insider article entitled The Lucky Birth suggests that this was an arranged marriage. It was the only place where I saw the word arranged come up in terms of Sekiryo and Fusajiro's daughter, Tei. All of these Japanese names are going to be a mouthful for me, so I'm going to mispronounce things all over the place. Sorry about that. So I'm not sure if this was like arranged by Fusajiro himself, or if this was even an arranged marriage at all. Those weren't uncommon in Japan at the time. But regardless, Sekiryo ended up marrying Tei, and he would basically just be adopted by the Yamauchi family and would end up with the Yamauchi name, and that would make him the next in line to take over Nintendo, which he did in 1929 when Fusajiro retired. The company continued to prosper under Sekiryo. Sekiryo and Tei, like Tei's father, never had a son, but their daughter Kimi would marry a man named Shikanojo Inaba, who would, like Sekiryo, take the Yamauchi name upon being married. Unlike Sekiryo, he would not take over Nintendo, as he abandoned his family just a few years after he and Kimi had a son. That son was named Hiroshi Yamauchi. All of you fellow amateur video game historians probably already recognize that name. Kimi, unable to raise a son by herself, sent Hiroshi to live with his grandparents. In Mary Firestone's book, Nintendo, the Company and Its Founders, she describes the young Hiroshi thusly, quote, "As he grew into his teenage years, he became the opposite of the modest Japanese gentleman he was raised by his grandparents to be. He developed a brash lifestyle that made a spectacle of his wealth. He carried himself publicly with an arrogant and devil-may-care attitude." He would enroll in law school at Waseda University in Tokyo in 1945. Just a few years later, his grandfather would suffer a stroke and needed to hand control of the company to somebody, Hiroshi being the most obvious choice. But his grandson demanded a few things from Sekiryo before taking on the company, which were granted. And once Hiroshi took over, there was a bloodbath, metaphorically speaking. Hiroshi demanded that his only other relative at the company be fired, along with most of the current management. Hiroshi didn't want there to be any question about who was in charge, nor be bogged down by old conservative managers. He wanted to be free to chart a new course for Nintendo. And that is pretty much what he did. Under Hiroshi Yamauchi's leadership, Nintendo would try a lot of different new business ventures before finding success with toys and then video games. But this deep dive has probably gone on long enough. We will cover more of that in a future deep dive, probably. But there you go. That's the story of the Yamauchis.
Wow, I didn't know practically any of that, so thank you. That was a really cool history lesson. Yeah, you know, I've never really known anything about like what kind of person Hiroshi Yamauchi was as like a young man or anything. I just mostly know him as like a really angry old tyrant in the like video game years of Nintendo.
It sounds like he was just always kind of a tyrant.
Does sound like that, yeah.
But he did, you know, eventually direct Nintendo towards video games. So, you know, you got to give him credit for that, I suppose. But
he was a pretty smart businessman. I think that's fair to say, even if he does seem like he was kind of a nightmare person. No, that's really cool. Thank you for that. And, you know, really, honestly, good job with all of the Japanese name pronunciation. I know that is very difficult. So thank you for taking that on. That was very brave.
I tried.
Ha 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 ha.
Super Mario World. I mean, yeah. What can we say about Super Mario World that we haven't already said?
I think we devoted an entire episode to it the first time. We just talked about Super Mario World for like an hour and a half or something.
Yeah, although actually that episode is no longer up because of the audio issues. I was
right, yeah.
I screwed it up. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about Super Mario World because like I've got a, you know, I have a lot of fond memories wrapped up in this game.
Same.
I received this game along with my Super Nintendo, like the mm-hmm. year that there was a huge snowstorm. I have very vivid memories of like playing this game. What, you know, as school was being canceled, much to my relief, cause I had a horrible teacher that year. We would play this game for hours and then we would go outside and build snow forts and build like little snow P-switches and Goombas and stuff.
It was
a very fun winter with, you know, like I said, just a lot of really fond memories wrapped up in mm-hmm. around that game. But for the game itself, I mean, like, I think this game plays like a dream. I still think it's the best Mario game ever, even with a lot of, you know, really amazing games that have come out since then. Hey, the recent Super Mario Wonder, which might be my second favorite 2D Mario game now. You know, it has some of the same vibes of discovery and just not knowing what's going to happen in that next level that I think this game has as well. But I mean, obviously, you know, I'm an adult. I'm probably never going to have that kind of relationship with the game anymore. But I really think like, you know, any of the younger folks out there who might have really enjoyed Super Mario Wonder who somehow haven't played this game, you should try it out. Like, I really think this game still holds up. It's just an amazing experience. I love all the secret exits. I love, you know, like really picking apart these levels, just going every which way to try and find those hidden areas. I love that this game has like a secret world and then a secret world within the secret world. Yeah, it's just a bunch of fun little things in this game to find. And like, and on the face of it, like it's kind of a simple game too. In some ways it's not even as, complex as like Super Mario Brothers 3 was. You don't have like these very different worlds. You know, these very different maps that really change the environment greatly, but I don't know. There's like a cohesiveness to this world that I actually really, really appreciate that make me like this game a little bit more than even Super Mario Brothers 3.
I agree. I agree with everything you said, actually. I think this is a great game. I think this is one of the best games ever made. It was my first Super Nintendo game that came with my Super Nintendo as well. And yeah, I just think it's kind of a magic game. You know, I think that the cohesiveness of the world is really the thing that is so special about this. And the feeling that, there's, you know, just layer upon layer of secrets built into this. And, yeah, it's just, God, every time I play this game, so, you know, even if I'm sitting down to play it, and I'm like, you know, I'll just play a few minutes of it. This happened to me this time when I was, you know, just sort of, because I've played this so many times, I didn't really need to play it again for this episode of the show. But I sat down to play it for a little while, and I lost an hour to it, you know? Like, I just kept playing because it's so, it controls so well. The levels are so elegantly designed, and everything all just kind of fits together, you know? Like, I think that they made some really smart changes from Mario 3 here, like integrating things like kind of bonus games and, you know, little like side events into the levels themselves instead of having them be like kind of separate things that pop up on the map. The fact that, you know, the end of level bonus game is you know, something that you don't see every level, and that sometimes there are other little bonus games that show up just, you know, by going through a pipe or something. It's really cool. It's really fun. This has the wonderful addition of the ghost houses, which are much more kind of puzzle type stages, with usually like some kind of gimmick for figuring out how to get through them, and often multiple different exits that lead to other new levels, is just incredible. And yeah, this is my absolutely my favorite 2D Mario game. I haven't played Mario Wonder yet. I'm very excited to play that, but I don't know how you do one of these better than this game, frankly.
Yeah, honestly, like, I would love it if Nintendo just made a Super Mario World 2 and it was just like the same engine, the same graphics and everything, but just added a few more features to it, like, you know, maybe making Peach and Toad playable and yeah, you know, like little things like that. Like, I don't know if this game needs much more than that, but I have discovered new things about this game in the year of our Luigi 2023 that I did not know before. Like, there's a level early on where you're just running and it's kind of meant to tell you, like, hey, this is the kind of thing that can happen. As you're just running through the level, you know, they just give you a flat ground to walk on or run across and not much else. So they're assuming that you're probably going to be running. And as you do that, a mushroom just pops up for no reason. And it turns out, like, there's a bunch of these hidden throughout the game where there's just like four little points around one specific area that you have to hit. And so, like, a power up or a one up mushroom or something will pop out of it once you've hit that fourth point.
That's really cool. That's super cool. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, there's apparently a whole bunch of them just hidden around. So now I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna have to play this game again and just find all of those. There are like three up moons that are very well hidden throughout various parts of the game. Which, like,
three up moons? Out, I don't think I even knew about that as a thing.
Yeah there are what three the up hell? Moons. Yep.
And, that's amazing.
Yeah, I knew about them from reading them in the instruction manual, and I think I found one or two. Yeah. Like, I think at least one of them you will just find through, you know, finding the alternate exits. But there are some that I did not know about, you know, until somewhat recently. That's just like the level of like, oh, we're just going to hide fun little things in this game. And the thing is, like, not knowing about those didn't make me feel like, you know, back in the day, like that I missed something, you know, like I still did the thing of beating the game and finding all the exits and beating all of the secret, you know, stages, you know, changing the game's color scheme to be more autumnal.
Yeah.
which is a neat thing. Changing like the Koopa Troopas into Mask Troopas. What a fantastic game this is.
And I want to talk a little bit, too, about the new power-ups that are in this game, because one thing that this is another thing where I think that they switched out the kind of breadth of different kinds of power-ups that existed in Mario 3 for just a couple of different kinds. But they added so much depth to those that it's a really extraordinary thing. So kind of really the main ones are Yoshi, which is a whole new concept for a Mario game, a rideable character that, you know, both gives you a bunch of different options for how to, like, deal with enemies and also is kind of variable in and of itself because of, like, the different powers that Yoshi gains from having different colored Koopa Troopa shells in his mouth and even, like, the different colored Yoshis that just automatically have one of those powers. And there's also the cape, and the cape is just the best power up. I think the most versatile and you know, elegantly designed power up that's ever been in maybe not just a Mario game, maybe a platform game as a whole.
We've talked about the cape before in the context of other games, but, like, I like how it is just it's really easy to use. For the purposes
of, like, you can use it kind of the way you used, like, you know, the raccoon tail in Mario 3, you know, if you just to get up to places. But the fact that there are all these different things you can do with it once you're in the air, different ways to, you know, glide and dive and, you know, different options those open up for you just solely based on the way you use the controls to manipulate Mario in the air is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, like, the game never demands, even to, like, 100%, it never demands that you, like, figure out how to use the cape expertly. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like it was designed to, like, hey, if you just want to, you know, find all the stuff in the game, you can do that pretty easily. Just, you know, get a running start, fly up there, and there you go. But like, if you want to get really good at using the cape, you can do all sorts of really weird tricks. It's been a, I think it's been a pretty big part of speedrunning this game.
Yeah, it absolutely has. Yeah.
Yeah, like it feels like an extra toy to play around with and not something that Nintendo is demanding you get really proficient with to, you know, to reach secret areas and things like that. There are maybe like one or two areas where you have to be pretty good with it, but it never demands, like, you know, you sink hours into the game getting really, you know, getting a lot of practice with it. You know, that's something you can do if you want to. And if you do want to, like, there's a lot of fun things you can do with that.
Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that also another thing that's worth talking about is, like, this is also a game that was clearly designed to show off some elements of the Super Nintendo technically in maybe a less flashy way than like F-Zero. But in a way that is really honestly pretty significant for the gameplay. You know, the fact that they were able to use things like transparencies for the ghosts and the different like size of some of the sprites they're able to use here are really impressive. The way that like the levels can kind of sprawl out in different directions, and you know, just the things, the little things that are added to it with like what the Super Nintendo's like sound hardware can do. Like, this feels very much, even though a lot of it's honestly pretty simple, and definitely in comparison to some of the games we're seeing in like 93, a lot less embellished. It's still unmistakably a Super Nintendo game.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I really adore this game. I doubt there will ever be a game that I love quite as much as this. I do think that it is, like, for what it's doing, for the kind of game that it is as close to a perfect video game as I think you could ever hope for, you know?
Yep. I 100% agree with you. And I still, you know, stand by our original placement of this at the tippy top of the list. And obviously it's an A tier game. Yeah. You know, unquestionably. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with it before we close things out on Super Mario World?
No, I think I've said my piece. I think
Oh no, please.
I would say if there's any flaws in this game, I might say like the lack of variety with the bosses. But even then, like, I'm thinking of like the Koopalings, and I'm ignoring like, oh yeah, there were like those weird Reznor fights where you're fighting the rhinoceros things on the spinning platforms, or the one ghost fight that you have to do to find a secret area. And then, you know, like the Bowser fight, like the first time I encountered that, I was not expecting that was how that fight was going to play out.
Sure.
It's really cool. It's a very dramatic moment, and it's just amazing. It's fantastic. So yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what else there is to say about it. It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's great. Just to briefly touch on the manual for this one, this is probably the least surprising manual of any of the ones that I've read for this episode, or this set of episodes, but a really good manual, some really nice artwork, a lot of really great just drawings of Mario in action, and like, this game maybe needs a manual less than any of the other launch games for the Super Nintendo, but it still does, I think, a good job of trying to, like, explain all of the things you can do in it and getting you ready for the adventure you're about to have. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I love this game.
I mean,
I just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could talk for hours. Like, we didn't even mention, like, the new spin jump mechanic that this game adds over the previous Mario games. Like, there's just so much here. It's really incredible. So, but we should probably leave it as it is. You know, amazing game. And if you've never experienced Super Mario World, I really think you should. I really think you should try it out.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't like 2D platformers, this one's really easy to get into. It's not excruciatingly difficult at any point. You know, some areas are more challenging than others, but you know, it's a, it's a real fun time.
And I think with that, we're going to head out for this one. But don't worry, folks. We'll be back soon to discuss the other three launch games for the Super Nintendo. That's coming up. That's going to be our next episode. So,
next time. And just to remind everyone what those are, we will be talking about Gradius 3, Pilot Wings, and Sim City.
So please join us for that. We hope you are enjoying our even more retro dalliance within our retro gaming podcast. And we'll see you next time. Until then, I'm Emmy Zero.
I'm Chase Keys.
Play it loud.
For show notes, game rankings, links to social media, research references, and more, check out our website, snescapades.show. Our intro-outro song is How Now Brown Cow by TechnoAxe, who very generously offers a ton of great music for free at technoaxe.com, TEKNOAXE.com. Thanks for listening.